Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. On this week's episode, we'll go over the most noteworthy hot stove action from the past 2 weeks, including Yusei Kikuchi's deal with the Mariners, the mega trade that sent Yasiel Puig to the Reds, and David Robertson signing with the Phillies. Before we start, though, we have an important announcement to make regarding the future of THT Audio. Due to various professional changes, both Sarah and I will have to step down from the podcast at the end of the month. Unfortunately, this means that THT Audio will not continue beyond that. We appreciate everyone who supported us over the past year and a half of the podcast run, and we hope you enjoy our last few remaining episodes. So, Japanese pitcher Yusei Kikuchi has officially signed with an MLB team. Kikuchi agreed to a deal with the Mariners, the exact terms of which are a bit unusual. According to Greg Johns of MLB.com, the unique deal is for $43 million over an initial 3 years with a $13 million player option for 2022. But the option can potentially be replaced by an additional four-year $66 million extension by the club that would convert the deal to 7 years total. What do we expect from Kikuchi, and do we think this sets a precedent for future contracts?
I think that we can probably expect somewhere around an above average year from Kikuchi. I think we've seen Japanese players in recent years being able to immediately come over to the major leagues and have a pretty decently sized impact with their teams. So I think from him we can see, he'll probably kind of be one of the standouts for the Mariners rotation as it currently stands. And I see him being kind of a big draw for Mariners fans. In terms of his contract, I think we will see a lot of similar contracts. I think we've kind of seen some similar ones just with American players this past off season, and I think we'll continuously see these sorts of players for Japanese players so long as Japanese teams don't kind of try to avoid them as best as possible and kind of implement measures that kind of forbid these kinds of contracts, because MLB clubs only have to pay the posting fee for or pay the Japanese club for the number of guaranteed years. So the fewer guaranteed years there are, the less MLB teams will have to pay out to get these players. So I think that's kind of what we're going to see happen.
Yeah, I think that he's going to probably be a mid-level starter in MLB. Don't think he's expected to be, you know, like a superstar ace necessarily, but that doesn't mean that he's not going to be good to above average. He's got certainly stuff that is major league ready, and he's going to pretty much instantaneously move right up to the top of the Mariners rotation now that Paxton's gone. Which that in itself is kind of interesting. It's clearly kind of a long-term move for the Mariners in that, you know, they're not competing this year, but they're still making this sort of signing. So it may be a while before he's maybe like second in that rotation now after Gonzalez, according to the depth chart. So, you know, it's a... He certainly has a place on the Mariners, even if it's a team that isn't going to be competing immediately. But it was still kind of surprising that he went to them of all teams. And as for the contract, I think Mary nailed it. I think that the unusual contract thing has been a trend that we've seen recently, even going as far back as like Kenta Maeda's contract with the Dodgers and how heavily incentive laden that was. But as Mary mentioned, we've seen some other kind of bizarre contracts this offseason, including what we'll talk about later, which is Zach Britton's contract with the Yankees. So I don't know that it's setting a precedent per se, but I think it is part of a broader trend.
Yeah, I think with the Mariners, just because of the state of the team, he's going to move, you know, somewhere into the top of the rotation quickly, just because, well, they don't really have much of a top of the rotation when he should be starting as like a mid-level starter. But because the Mariners are clearly going toward a rebuild, you know, it doesn't really matter much in the short term. But you know, like Sarah said, they're clearly building for the long term. And I think also, as far as the deal goes, it's not really setting a precedent, you know. It's really just kind of continuing this trend. But it is definitely more team-friendly than it is player-friendly. I mean, you can see the dollar signs and think, oh, that's good for the player. But then you realize, like, it's a team option or, like, a team option to extend, and you know that depends on performance, or maybe the team just doesn't want to do it. So I think that's like my biggest worry, that there's going to be more like team friendly contracts that don't value the player's labor. But you know, that's another discussion for another topic.
Well, moving away from signings and toward trades, it finally happened. The Dodgers traded Yasiel Puig. Puig was part of a four-player package sent to the Reds, along with Matt Kemp, Alex Wood, and Kyle Farmer. In turn, the Dodgers received two prospects, as well as Homer Bailey, whom LA released immediately so that he could become a free agent. This is a trade with a clear immediate impact for the Reds. What does the acquisition of these four players mean for them in 2019 and potentially beyond?
It means they get to see Puig smack a whole bunch of dingers out of the Great American Ballpark. And I am extremely jealous. But in all seriousness, yeah, no, they have a new right fielder. Puig is clearly going to slot in there and probably be the everyday starter there. Got another right-handed power bat in Kemp, although he's probably going to be more of a bench-slash-backup player just because of what we saw with him last season. Got a solid piece in the rotation in Alex Wood. They gave up Homer Bailey, and Wood is kind of stepping in to replace him but also be an upgrade to him. So that works out pretty nicely. And they got a really solid backup catcher in Kyle Farmer. You know, not the greatest hitter necessarily, but he's a guy that's valuable to have around for sure in case of injury. So it's yeah, they definitely had a pretty significant boost to their 2019 team right there. Don't know that they're necessarily still at the level of competing with the Cubs and the Brewers and even the Cardinals at this point, but they're making a statement. I think that they're not just sitting around doing nothing. They're making efforts to get back into it.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, that like while this might not, you know, propel them to the top of the NL Central, it's definitely letting all the other teams know that, you know, they're still around and that, you know, they'll probably have their window of contention opening sooner than later. So in the long run, it's really just establishing themselves once the other windows, probably particularly the Cubs, maybe the Cardinals windows start to close a little bit more. And I think they're gearing up for that.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think this trade means that the Reds do think they can compete at least for the division in the coming years. I think it means it's going to be overall a pretty fun and bizarre season for the NL East, or the NL Central rather. And I think it just means that a lot of people are going to fall in love with Puig, and that is never a bad thing for you know, our personal enjoyment on the podcast and baseball's betterment in itself. Moving on to the Dodgers side of things, what exactly were they thinking with this trade?
That's the million-dollar question right there, isn't it? The original kind of thought that everyone seemed to collectively have at once was, okay, they're gearing up to sign Bryce Harper. That hasn't happened yet. Doesn't mean it couldn't still happen, but it just based on all that we've heard, which admittedly hasn't been much, but I guess we haven't been hearing much to make it sound like that's imminent in any way. So there may be other plans in place. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Harper was like plan A, but, you know, obviously you can't solely rely on that. You need to have other plans in place. And, you know, maybe that's AJ Pollock. Maybe that's trading for someone. It's all kind of bizarre because it's like they trade Puig and Kem, and then it's like you hear rumors that, oh, they're looking to sign a right-handed impact bat. And it's like, you had those. What's going on? So it's a little perplexing for sure. If it wasn't clear space for Harper, then it's even more perplexing. So we'll see what actually ends up happening. I think that if it wasn't all for Harper, there's probably going to be a lot of upset fans, and understandably so, because it's kind of hard to square away otherwise.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, when the trade first happened, it was like, oh, this is clearly going to, you know, make space for Harper in the outfield. But as it kind of stands right now, it's like, well, will they or won't they sign? And by they, I mean Harper and Machado as well. But I don't know. I think there's also kind of like an added aspect of getting prospects back in this deal. And they're two pretty good prospects. And I think that it's also that they're gearing up to for like the what if their window closes sooner than they would like. So they're also kind of like restocking the farm system a bit in that regard. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it also goes to show that Dodgers were kind of thinking a tiny bit smartly about this, which is really just, oh, they're at least preparing for like, what if they don't sign Bryce Harper and they're going to have to do a rebuild sooner than later.
Mm-hmm. So
that's what I was thinking they were doing.
I wonder if the Dodgers would have made this move had Arizona clearly not decided to go for a bit of a rebuild this offseason. Because it seems like this is the kind of move the Dodgers could make that would either kind of sort of start a quick rebuild, or it could be something that they could make and still be able to compete for the division. So I do wonder if this was their thinking, where they thought, just depending on what else happens in the off season, they have, you know, towards the end of the off season, they can either, you know, go hard after some free agent or make some sort of trade at the very last minute that could propel them toward contention, or if the pieces just, you know, end up falling in a way that makes it much more logical for them to go for a bit of a quick rebuild, and kind of like what Arizona is doing. They have that option now as well.
Also, I think that with the way the NL West is, like, the Padres window isn't going to open up for another season or two. The Giants are God. And then the Diamondbacks are, you know, are seemingly blowing up their team and trying to rebuild. So the only clear competition for the Dodgers is the Rockies, and the Rockies are still kind of trying to figure things out. So while it won't be necessarily the easiest path for them to get the NL West, it's certainly a higher chance of them getting it. So, I don't know, it would feel weird if, or not feel weird, but like, it would seem weird if the Dodgers also tried to do a quick rebuild at the same time when they still have a window open, just because literally everyone else in the NL West is some kind of, oh my God, what, why am I watching this?
Yeah, but I don't know. The Rockies are not to be underestimated, I think. So I don't know. I think the Dodgers need to be a little more serious than all that.
Yeah, especially since like the Rockies are like trying to figure out what to do with their pitching. And once they figure that out, then that's going to be a real threat.
Yeah, and it seems like the two wild cards are kind of trending toward either, you know, a central team or an east team, or you know, two of each, probably two central teams before two east teams. But it seems like the Dodgers can rely less and less on the idea of winning a wild card spot.
Yeah, definitely.
It, basically, the NL as a whole is going to be a log jam for the wild card for years to come.
Or they're going to have 18 or whatever, 10 teams doing rebuilds, and it's going to be just six teams duking it out. Or I don't know how many teams are in the NL,
clearly.
Or we're
going to see 10 game 163s.
Okay, now maybe that I could be into.
Yeah, I could get behind that.
Especially since chaos.
My team, my favorite team, would not be involved in any of that, so I could just sit back and take it all in.
Thanks, Mary.
All right. Well, flipping back to the free agent market, we had some movement on the relief pitcher market. The Phillies signed David Robertson to a two-year, $23 million contract with the club option for 2021. Additionally, Zach Britton signed back with the Yankees, agreeing to a three-year, $39 million deal with an option for a fourth year that the team may exercise after the second year. If they don't, Britton may elect to become a free agent. So another one of those kind of unusual contracts we alluded to earlier. That said, we'll start with Robertson. What does he bring to the Phillies, and what's left for them to do now?
He brings, I think, a lot of stability, a lot of consistency to their bullpen. He can play a bunch of different roles. I assume he'll either win the closer job or be the primary setup man. And I think that that is something the Phillies kind of needed. They needed a guy like Robertson who has so much experience to kind of come in and be that anchor for that kind of takes care of a lot of their bullpen concerns.
God, Mary, I was also going to say stability and consistency. So I think he brings a lot more strength to the bullpen, and that's going to be, you know, a force to be reckoned with eventually. I think what's left for the Phillies to do is really just bring in that one really big impact bat, and whether it's Machado or Harper, and it's like rumors are more like saying that it's leaning more towards Machado. If they just get one bat that can, you know, that can slug 30 home runs a year or something, then that's really just what's left for them to do. Or they can find someone on the cheap who can do the same thing. But really, they're just looking for an impact hitter at this point.
I think that about covers that. What do we make of the Yankees' decision to bring Britton back?
Well, I think they obviously are assuming that this past season for Britton was very much a fluke season and not an indication of what he will be in the future. So I think this is kind of a good move for the Yankees. If it doesn't pan out, it's not too much of a disaster. And there are obviously still a bunch of free agent relief pitchers on the market that the Yankees could acquire as well in order to give them a bit more of a cushion if Zach Britton's 2018 is indicative of his 2019 season. So I think it is a pretty good move for the Yankees. Obviously, the contract is quite bizarre, and I have a hard time kind of, you know, just in the landscape of Major League Baseball, seeing how it could be more of a bonus for Britton than it would be for the Yankees. But I guess we'll see what happens over the next two seasons with him.
Yeah, I think, the Yankees know that their biggest concern is pitching, whether it be starting or relief, and that's what they're focusing on, which is, very important considering they're in the same division as the Red Sox. You're welcome, Mary. But the thing that I just find weird is how the contract is structured. It's just, I've never seen a contract where they can decline an option after the second year when it's a 3-year deal. It's just very bizarre. But like Mary said, it's clear that the Yankees think that his 2018 was a fluke, that he's better than that, and that there's a lot of potential still with Zach Britton. And at this point, because the Yankees need all the help that they can get in pitching, it makes the most sense. And this probably isn't going to be the last pitching move that the Yankees make, but it's definitely going to be an important one.
It's funny, like that we're talking about. Oh, his 2018 season was really off when he had an ERA plus of 140. And obviously, we're talking comparatively here by Zach Britton standards. But that's I do think that he wasn't quite what we know he can be last year. He's obviously had some injury concerns and whatnot. But he was much better after he went from Baltimore to the Yankees. So I think they're hoping that that's what they get. And yeah, their bullpen was a big strength last year, and they want to keep it that way. Bringing Britton back, a guy that they know, a guy that they think has good stuff and that they think has the potential to return to his really, really good self. It makes a lot of sense. You've kind of touched on what's weird about the contract. It's hard to see why it would be an advantage to him to opt out when his option has been declined for the fourth year, presumably because he hasn't been pitching well. So I don't know. It's definitely a strange one. But he agreed to it, so I don't know. He probably had his reasons for that. So now that Robertson and Britton are off the board, who do we think is the next free agent reliever to sign?
I mean, it could, there are so many. It really could be anyone. I don't think it'll be Kimbrel or Cody Allen because I think they'll be after a bit more money or longer contracts. As Kimbrel stated, he wanted at least a 6-year contract. So I think it could be somebody like Adam Ottavino, who's kind of been up there with the names that we've just mentioned. So I think he could kind of be next to go if teams don't want to wait out somebody like Kimbrel.
Yeah, I think Kimbrel would probably be one of the last relievers to sign, if anything. Not really sure who would be the next to sign. I think, Ottavino is definitely, up at the top of the list, but it's also kind of one of those things where you could just put a bunch of names on a dartboard and see where the dart lands.
For sure. That said, I am going to put my hat in the ring for Ottavino as well. Can't wait to be wrong on this one. Seems like he's due to sign somewhere.
And maybe his signing will be, the thing that gets all the rest of the big signings started. We say
Yes.
after every signing, maybe this one.
This will be it. Maybe this. Maybe
Never
this will be
is.
it. So, on something completely different, Mariners GM Jerry DePoto, if you thought we wouldn't mention him this week, well, you're wrong. DePoto confirmed this week that Ichiro will continue his playing career with the team's opening series in Tokyo and left open the possibility of Ichiro earning a roster spot later in the season as well, stating that Ichiro once said that he'd like to play to the age of 50. This week, Kikuchi had one of the best quotes ever about Ichiro. Quote, Mr. Ichiro is a person in the sky, a legend. I don't know if he really exists. I want to meet and talk with him first. When I do have the opportunity to step on the field with him, it'll be a great moment. Now he will have the opportunity to play alongside Ichiro, which must be a dream come true, plus the opening series is in Japan. So that
adds double bonus,
a whole nother layer to it. So how much of a must watch series has this become?
I think a pretty big must watch series, particularly for, I'm coming close to saying, every single person living in Japan. Ichiro has been quite a star for them for a long time, I think transcending even just the sport of baseball. So I think it's definitely going to be a must-watch series for every single Japanese baseball fan. And I think it's definitely going to be a must-watch series for specifically Mariners fans, and now a large part of the baseball community, because who doesn't love Ichiro? Who does not want to see Ichiro play in Japan?
I don't trust anyone who doesn't like Ichiro Suzuki.
I think that's reasonable. yeah, this is going to be some great baseball. Games are going to be happening very early in the morning for those of us in the U.S. So the games are scheduled for 2:35 a.m. Pacific time. So 5:35 for folks on the East Coast, and the rest of you in other time zones can figure it out for yourselves. But that's, nonetheless, I think we can all agree that's some very early start times. So I don't know how many people are actually going to be able to watch live, but the beauty of that is that highlights exist, and you can go on to MLB.com and various Twitter feeds and see video footage of the events and be like, whoa, this is so cool. I'm so glad this is a thing that's happening. So I think that if the games themselves aren't must watch, the highlights are going to be really, really something to behold.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily like must watch, but it's at least like must keep tabs on and watch all the great parts of it, because it's Ichiro playing in Tokyo with the Mariners. It's Ichiro playing with Kikuchi with the Mariners in Tokyo. And, like, let's be real, this is probably going to be what people are going to be talking about in the baseball sphere for a while, until, like, the rest of the opening days happen. But it's still, like, a really great moment. So, do we expect Ichiro to play beyond these two games?
I'm a skeptic on that. I think he's probably past the points where anyone realistically thinks that he can contribute to a major league squad in a meaningful way, which makes me sad to say, but I don't see it happening myself, but Ichiro always has the capability to surprise. So I very much hope he proves me wrong.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. It seems pretty unlikely, and this would be obviously just an incredible kind of final hurrah for Ichiro, and I think that's what it has been designed to be, going back to kind of when it was announced and when Ichiro decided to kind of quote-unquote retire, but not really. So I think this will kind of be his final two games in Major League Baseball, but as you said, it's Ichiro. The sky's the limit with him, so who really, he could come back in like five seasons, who really knows, you know? He could kind of revive the player manager type position.
I would love if he would be a player manager type again, because honestly, baseball needs something different. And that would be awesome. Also, it's Ichiro, and I basically kind of approve of whatever Ichiro decides to do on the field. That being said, I'm not expecting Ichiro to play past these two games, but I'm just going to leave that window open, because it's like, you know how they say that you can't predict baseball? You can't predict Ichiro. Like, that's really the whole gist of his existence.
I mean, he's just really a towering figure in terms of his greatness and his personality. Well, let's round out this hot stove discussion with a bit of Harper and Machado speculation. Obviously, not much is known about the offers they received, but a couple of pieces of potentially interesting information has become known this past week. It was reported that the Nationals' latest contract offer to Harper is, quote, much more than the $300 million that was originally floated around. Additionally, no team supposedly has offered Machado that much money, let alone surpassed it. But the Yankees, White Sox, and Phillies seem to have emerged as the primary contenders for him. What do we make of these rumors, and where and when do we think these players will sign?
So, I think Machado is going to sign first. I know before the holidays, it kind of was like said that Machado would probably announce which one of those three teams he would be signing with. I can't say for certain like which of the three is the front runner, but I think Machado is going to sign first. I also think there's a lot less pressure for Machado to sign. Also because his name is not Bryce Harper. As far as Bryce Harper goes, I'm not surprised that a team would offer more than the $300 million that was originally floated around, considering he is still very young. I still forget sometimes that how much younger he is than I am. And like he still has a long career ahead of him. And really, it's just someone just throw all the money at him, because clearly you're going to get what you pay for. Just do it.
Yeah. With these two guys, Harper is the guy whose name has more hype around it. And for that reason, it would feel anticlimactic if he were to sign first, I think. I think it'll be a late offseason thing, or at least later than Machado in the offseason. That's just kind of how it seems like it's going to play out. It could go anyway. Who really knows? He could sign as soon as we're done recording.
Don't say that.
It's going to happen. It's not going to happen, but it may happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with both of you. I see Harper as being one of the last kind of big name players to sign a contract. It seems like teams are kind of waiting him out while he's simultaneously waiting them out. And it just seems like it's going to be a thing that goes down to the wire. I definitely see Machado signing first. He seems to have a lot more interest currently, or at least disclosed interest, and we've been hearing kind of for the past week or so that these teams are in on him, and he'll make his decision kind of, you know, fairly soon. So it seems like because we're hearing those things about Machado and not Harper, it seems much more likely that Machado will sign before Harper. I would love Machado to to go to the White Sox or Phillies, not because my team plays against the Yankees, but because I think it would just make baseball that much more interesting, particularly if he went to the White Sox and kind of got them going and put a little more interest into the AL Central, which seems like it's just kind of full of teams that are currently treading water. And it seems like even Cleveland has kind of given up and said, okay, well, let's try and win the division with a 500 record. You know, who cares anymore? So I think that would just kind of make things a lot more interesting and kind of a lot more bearable as a fan.
Okay, but I want the NL chaos. So I want Machado to go to the Phillies because I want that 10 team game 163, because I clearly hate everyone, including myself.
Thank you, Jen. We appreciate your support.
What do you guys think of all of this and then Harper potentially just ending up back with the Nationals?
Yeah.
This would add to the NL, you know, chaos, you know.
In its way. And then it's like they have a glut of outfielders, so that probably leads to another trade, and it could work out. It could give us some more action.
just anything at this point that would lead to more action.
Well, speaking of action, who's up for some baseball history?
Always.
Let's close out with another segment of This Week in Baseball History. On January 6, 1914, baseball declares it mandatory for each park to have a green and blank center field wall in order to help batters better pick up the ball out of the pitcher's hand.
On January 12, 1920, the draft method of picking in inverse order is finally implemented after several years of campaigning by Dodgers owner Charles Edits.
And finally, on January 8, 1956, the NAACP awards Jackie Robinson the Springarm Medal, given annually, quote, for the highest or noblest achievement by a living African American during the preceding year or years. The previous year, MLK Jr. was the recipient.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at Sarah Wexler 32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. You can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bedsound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.